The main cause is a phenomenon known as the greenhouse effect. Gases in the atmosphere, such as water vapor, carbon dioxide, methane, nitrous oxide, and chlorofluorocarbons, let the sun's light in, but keep some of the heat from escaping, like the glass walls of a greenhouse. The more greenhouse gases in the atmosphere, the more heat gets trapped, strengthening the greenhouse effect and increasing the Earth's temperature. Human activities, like the burning of fossil fuels, have increased the amount of CO2 in the atmosphere by more than a third since the Industrial Revolution. The rapid increase in greenhouse gases in the atmosphere has warmed the planet at an alarming rate. While Earth's climate has fluctuated in the past, atmospheric carbon dioxide hasn't reached today's levels in hundreds of thousands of years.
Climate change is here, and this summer in particular, more than ever. As you just heard in the report by the National Geographic, scientists say the main cause of climate change is burning fossil fuels such as oil, gas, and coal. When burned, fossil fuels release carbon dioxide into the air, causing the planet to heat up. I'm Katerina Badzaiki, and in this week's Infinitely Curious program of ERT and the Voice of Greece, we will look at the speed climate change is shaping the Earth's atmosphere and affecting the flora, fauna, and temperatures. Recently, huge numbers of jellyfish have turned up in swarms off Thermaikos waters in the northern town of Thessaloniki in Greece, behind the city's concert hall. There are so many of the gelatinous creatures that they threaten to clog up the desalination plants used to supplement the country's water supply and send swimmers back onto dry land. Together with them, algae and garbage that have gathered in the area, combined with a bad smell, create a very ugly image. Scientists attribute the event to the phenomenon of eutrophication. This is a process that is mainly observed in lakes or closed shallow bays and has to do with the high concentration of nutrients, such as nitrate and phosphate compounds, above normal limits, largely caused through human activity. But this isn't the only reason. Climate change and global warming seem to contribute to the rising numbers of these creatures as the water gets hotter. This month's Israeli jellyfish bloom occurred off the coast of Haifa, a city in the country's north. But at least one study has found that many jellyfish populations around the world have been increasing since the 1950s. That study noted that jellyfish populations have increased in places as far-flung as the northeast United States, Japan, Hawaii, and even Antarctica. Warmer waters tend to lead to more jellyfish, notes the Scripps Institution of Oceanography at the University of California, San Diego, which could mean some places will see more jellyfish as the oceans heat up. Some 90% of the excess heat caused largely by burning fossil fuels has ended up in the ocean, according to the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institute. All that heat is taking a toll. Since 1901, the uppermost layer of the ocean where most marine life is has warmed by 1.5 degrees Celsius, according to Woods Hole. The effect of this warming on jellyfish populations may not be uniform. For one, the climate crisis is driving down oxygen levels in the ocean, and some jellyfish are tolerant of lower oxygen environments, which could make them more dominant. But the climate crisis is also making the ocean more acidic, and scientists don't know yet how a more acidic ocean could affect our stinging, tentacled companions. The climate crisis has already affected, in some cases, irreparably, some of the most important marine ecosystems of the Mediterranean. The Mediterranean is becoming the fastest warming and saltiest sea on our planet, according to a new WWF report released on World Oceans Day. Almost 1,000 alien species have already migrated into the increasingly warmer waters of the Mediterranean and replaced endemic species, while increasing extreme weather events are wreaking havoc on marine angiosperm meadows such as Posidonia meadows and coral reefs in the region. No matter what, jellyfish are a link to marine ecosystems that have been long extinct. Scientists have found jellyfish fossils more than 500 million years old, meaning that they've watched the dinosaurs both come and go in their long lifespan. WWF's new report, The Impact of Climate Change on the Mediterranean, Stories from a Warming Sea, highlights the six main impacts climate change is having on marine biodiversity and the resulting changes in key fish species and habitats, as well as the consequential impact on local communities. WWF also highlights the dangerous link between climate-driven impacts and human-induced pressures on marine life, such as overfishing, pollution, coastal development and shipping, which have already severely damaged the resilience of our seas. The proper and efficient management of marine protected areas is deemed necessary. Today, protected areas cover only 9.68% of the Mediterranean, and only 1.27% have measures in place to effectively manage and protect sensitive ecosystems, according to WWF. We're joined by head of WWF office in Athens, Dimitris Karavelas. Dimitri, good morning and welcome to our program.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Now, I would like to begin by asking you, will heat choke us in the next 2 years, do you think?
Well, it's getting worse and worse by the year. And the reality is, as you just outlined in your introduction, that it's not just about the surface temperatures or the temperatures we're feeling outside. It's actually that our waters are heating up at a much, much faster rate than many other parts of the world. And so the Med is really becoming a hotspot in more than one way, with temperatures rising 20% faster than the global average. And so, over the next two or three years, we will be seeing even higher temperatures. We certainly need to take measures, urgent measures, to try and address this.
What does this mean for the marine life in the Mediterranean?
Well, a lot of the marine life is reaching its limits in terms of its temperature tolerance. Another very important trend that we're seeing is this influx of invasive species. As you outlined, there's something like 1,000 invasive species that have entered the Mediterranean. In places like Greece, for example, we've seen a population explosion of fish species like the rabbit fish or the lionfish. And these are species that actually displace a lot of the local species, can be very damaging to ecosystems, but also can be very damaging to people's livelihoods, to fisheries, to coastal fisheries in particular. So we're seeing very, very big differences at the ecosystem level, and those differences are starting to impact also our economies, unfortunately.
Why is jellyfish ever more present in Greek waters nowadays?
Yes, the reality is we're also seeing more jellyfish. Now, that's a combination of factors. Jellyfish, as you said, have been around since dinosaurs' times, but we're seeing more and more jellyfish blooms, and that is related to higher water temperatures, for sure. It's also related to overfishing. The fact that they're natural predators, the fish that would have eaten jellyfish eggs or larvae are being overfished, and so we're seeing less of them. It may also be related to stochastic events and to the normal cycles, if you like, life cycles of these species. The reality is, however, that we're seeing in more and more places higher populations of jellyfish, and that is not only impacting the ecosystems, but may also have the negative impacts on, for example, tourists and the aesthetic and recreational values of our seas. Let's hope that this doesn't get any worse, because we really would not like to see more blooms in the Mediterranean and more blooms in the beautiful waters of Greece.
Mm-hmm. You spoke of overfishing, then we have pollution, we have coastal development and shipping. Are these the only reasons for overheating and climate change, or fossil fuels, do they also play?
Yes, I mean, I think the elephant in the room when we talk about the climate crisis and how we can avert the climate crisis, the elephant in the room is fossil fuels. As long as we continue to rely on fossil fuels and burn fossil fuels, our CO2 emissions will, our greenhouse gas emissions will continue to rise. That will be causing global heating, and that will be having an impact on higher temperatures in the air, but also higher temperatures in our water. So we know what the problem is. We know what needs to be done. Now we need to just turn that reality, that scientific data, and those scientific conclusions into real action.
Mm-hmm. Taking a look at the report of WWF on wildfires, I mean, wildfires obviously is the symptom, okay? We don't know the reason behind it, whether it's arson or another reason why they're caused, especially in Greece this year and the year before, every year we have wildfires. Now, does this also affect climate change? And we've seen particularly rare high temperatures these past 2 weeks. Is this normal? Does this happen once in a lifetime, or is this something we'll be seeing every year, you think?
Well, unfortunately, this is the new norm, and wildfires are no stranger to Greece or to the Mediterranean ecosystems. But what is new are the conditions. The climate crisis is creating those conditions that are actually allowing for these forest fires to be more frequent, but also to be more intense. And so, in a nutshell, I would say that the climate crisis is making our forests much more vulnerable, but also making our forests much more valuable. And we need to really address this here and now. We need to understand that the approaches that we've taken to tackle forest fires over the last 50 years have simply failed, and we need to put a lot more emphasis on prevention outside of the summer months, before the summer months, in order to prepare for this. We will have forest fires in the future, and we need to see how we can manage them more effectively.
Okay, so what does WWF suggest needs to be done to address the issues of forest fires and forest management in terms of prevention?
Well, I think the key word is prevention, and prevention means it needs to operate at many levels. I think at the local level is probably the most important thing. We've heard a lot about municipalities and how they're being organized or not against forest fires. Well, it's very important that the municipalities actually have local fire prevention plans in place. They've put these together. They've implemented them far before the summertime has come. Those prevention plans actually include a key role for local society and local volunteers. I think one of the positive things that have come out of, hopeful things that have come out of the fires this summer is we're seeing this amazing surge of local people who want to assist as volunteers. I think we need to capitalize on that. I think we need to turn that into something that is more systematic, more organized, and part of a broader system. I'm not saying that the volunteers should be putting out the fires. They should be playing a supportive role towards the professional firefighters. But I think there's a critical role for the volunteers to play in the prevention mode. Volunteer teams can be manning lookout towers and looking out for fires because it's really important that we get to the fire. And it's very, very early stages. And so these are just some of the practical considerations and practical proposals that we've been making as an organization for quite some time, and we'll be insisting on this year again.
Yes, but they don't let them. I mean, every time we hear there's a fire, we also hear evacuation.
Well, that's true. And I think that is a reality following the tragic loss of human lives in Mati in 2018. And we can understand that evacuations are needed in some cases. But again, I would insist that we need to find a way to really include society in how forest fires are addressed. I think we also need to find a way to educate society more around this. You mentioned the causes of forest fires. We need to look deeper into that. In some cases, that may be arson, but the majority of cases in the data that we've seen are actually due to criminal negligence. I mean, people lighting barbecues in the middle of the summertime, or throwing their cigarettes out of their cars, or, doing things in the forest that are actually creating small fires or sparks that can actually ignite into a huge fire. So there's a lot to be done in terms of how society sees fires differently and can respond to this in a different way.
How easy is to start a fire? I mean, we've seen a video where a fire starts actually in the middle of the night, and there's obviously someone with his mobile phone there. And could that be overheating, and that actually develops in the middle of the night? And then we have another fire at 7:30 in the morning. And we also have almost 600 fires in the last 10 days.
Yes.
I mean, how possible is that all this is just to human error?
Well, it's not just human error, but I think it's a combination of factors. If we could factor out the human error aspect, though, I think that would be critically important. The fact that we are witnessing temperatures in Greece right now, 40 degrees plus, and we're still seeing people that are lighting fires in the middle of the forest while camping or throwing their cigarettes out of their cars is just criminal. It's absolutely criminal. And so I think that a lot needs to be done. There are other issues, whether it's power lines, whether it's arson or whatever else. One of our proposals is we really need to be honest and do a deep dive and analysis of where the causes of these forest fires are coming from and how to address them. And they may be different in some different places and at different times of the year, but we need to see how we actually address them.
Do you think that it's wildfires that cause high temperatures, or do you think that high temperatures are the cause for wildfires?
I think high temperatures are actually creating more favorable conditions for wildfires.
We saw in the last few days 50 degrees Celsius, 46 degrees Celsius, and 48. We've never seen that before in Greece.
Yes, we'll be seeing it again, unfortunately.
Every year?
Well, I don't know if we'll be seeing it every year, but we'll be seeing it more frequently. I think the projections are that whereas in the past we would see that every 50 to 60 years, now we will probably be seeing it every 2 to 3 years. So our response mechanism needs to be a response mechanism that is actually adapted to those new conditions. We can't ignore those new conditions. We can't continue with the business as usual approach because that system is just simply inadequate.
Going to the story of drones, and I was just thinking that the other day, having a conversation with a friend. Mm-hmm. Drones, you think, could help at least track fires, or a more sophisticated system where they could also track arsonists in the middle of the night? Is that a solution to the problem?
Well, I think we need to be open to what technology might be able to offer us. I'm not saying no to that, but I think there are also, more practical and easy ways perhaps to address this. There are volunteer groups, like I'm thinking of Parnitha Forest, which is very close to Athens, of course, where there's a volunteer group called Evasa, and for many, many years, these people have been playing an absolutely critical role in actually through lookout towers and performing their duties every night, being able to identify fires at a very, very early stage, inform the authorities and the firefighters, and really trying to get to the fire. I think the key in these new conditions is how do we get to the fire as soon as we possibly can? If you can get to a fire within 10 or 15 minutes of when it's broken out, then your probability of success of putting out that fire is much, much higher. Beyond that, it starts to become very, very difficult, as we're tragically seeing in so many places like Rhodes, Corfu, Evia, and other places.
What are the requests you are actually receiving right now with all these wildfires taking place at the same time? And what does WWF do about those requests?
Well, we are in contact with a number of volunteer groups throughout the country. We've been doing this not only during the summer, but for years now, trying to provide them with the technical equipment they need, but also to build their capacity in areas where they might need that. We're actually in contact with them now. For example, on Rhodes, we've supported two such volunteers teams in the past with equipment, and they need more equipment, so we're trying to get that equipment out to them to provide them with support in any possible way. The other request that we're also getting is how can we assist in what will happen in terms of restoration? So what will happen with these areas the day after the forest fires are put out? What type of flood prevention measures need to take place? How has biodiversity been affected, et cetera, et cetera? And we usually, what we do is we usually send out teams, field teams, to actually inspect these sites to be able to provide a more expert advice on what needs to happen, when it needs to happen, and how that needs to happen. And unfortunately, that's been something that we've been doing for quite a few years, and so we're quite accustomed to doing that. We'd like to be doing less and less of that, but unfortunately, as you see, the intensity of these fires is perhaps growing even more.
Mm-hmm. The severe heat this week and last week across Europe, do you think is unusual for the continent?
I think what is a surprise, these are predictions that were being discussed, I think, for decades. I think what is a surprise is that the speed at which it's happening is perhaps greater than what was expected. The frequency at which these events are happening is also greater than what has happened in the past. And I think also what is particularly alarming is that we're seeing very high temperatures and these extended heat waves happening in a number of continents at the same time. So it's happening in North America, it's happening in Europe, it's happening in Asia, all at the same time. And that is starting to become a very alarming, I would say, tipping point in what that might mean, and really concerning for what that might mean in the future.
Mm-hmm. We've seen that Europe is also highly urbanized. We have about 72% of European Union residents that live in cities, towns and suburbs. So we have concrete, glass, steel, urban environments and the relative lack of green spaces that actually turns these cities into heat islands that stay hotter than their surroundings. So my question to you is, for example, in the UK, they broke the record of the hottest temperature recorded at night. Mm-hmm. And also that causes health problems to people. Do you think that predictions about Greece becoming the Sahara of Europe in the next few years is a valid projection?
Well, I think all of Southern Europe, Greece, Spain, Italy, they were all going pretty much through the same situation. We do know that those climatic conditions will change in a big way. You're quite right in saying that the cities are, you know, cement cities, and in Greece, unfortunately, we've lost a lot of the green spaces that may have existed in the cities. I think there's a challenge for how we bring back those green spaces, because that is directly linked to the quality of our lives, and that's going to be a big challenge. I would also add that in a country like Greece, we have a challenging situation where we have a combination of settlements inside forests, either legally or illegally, and that's another different challenge in terms of fires and firefighting and how do you address it. So it's a very different situation to you know, countries like Canada, for example, with huge expanses of land with no settlements whatsoever.
Can you explain that a little bit further for our audience to understand? Because there are also people who actually do not live in Greece and do not understand how this works.
Yes, the point I'm making is that the forests in Greece are much smaller compared to many other countries. From a biodiversity perspective, however, they're very, very important. We have something like over 5,000 species of plants. About 20% of those species are endemic, so those are species that are only found in Greece. But in many of our forests, we actually have villages. We actually have settlements inside the forests. So from a firefighting perspective, it's not just about how do I manage the forest, how do I address the fire within that forest. It's about how do I protect the village and the villagers and the settlements when that fire has broken out. And how can I protect, how can I create a sort of buffer zone, for example, around those areas? How can I plan in advance where I want to develop these settlements, under which conditions these will be planned? Otherwise, the challenge will become even bigger in the future, and we will have these forest fires not only impacting the forests themselves, but the people in the villages that are located within the forests.
Mm-hmm. Locals complain that when authorities come to put the fires out, they ask them to evacuate, so they leave their homes. And most of them who actually had left their homes were burned down, and they blame authorities that they've actually were just looking at the fire and not doing anything about it. Is this the case, you think, or, you know, the dilemma of actually leaving your home or not leaving your home, especially when you know the area very well? And we're going back to your argument about staying and helping out is more helpful, but then more dangerous, isn't it?
Well, yes, I think it's a tough dilemma. And as I said earlier on, we had this tragic case in Mati 5 years ago in an area only 20 kilometers away from Athens, where 104 people died in a tragic fire that broke out and really in half an hour.
And today, and these past few days where we had the two people in Magnesia.
You're absolutely right. You're absolutely right. So I think it is a tough dilemma. I think evacuations are in order in many of these cases. But again, I would say that what is needed is preventive measures in advance. I mean, if we knew, if people had been trained, if there were plans in place for these areas in advance of when the forest fires broke out, then those people who had been trained, who had the equipment, who were part of a dedicated volunteer force, would know what their role would be. They could perhaps stay behind and protect the homes of these people, and the people who were less trained or older or wouldn't be able to do something to help out could actually evacuate. So I think we really need to be more customized in our approach and to see, as I said earlier on, where society can help out in a bigger way, but also how do we ensure that society is safe in making that happen.
Dimitris Karavelis, thank you for joining us and have a very
nice
day.
Thank you for having me.
And that was head of WWF office in Athens, Dimitris Karavelas.
What about sunrise? What about rain? What about all the things that you said we were to gain? What about killing fields? Is there a time? What about all the things that you said was yours and mine? Did you ever stop to notice all the blood we shed before? Did you ever stop to notice this crying earth, this weeping shore? About all the dreams that you said was yours and mine. Did
Did you ever stop to notice all the children dead from war? Did you ever stop to notice this crying earth as we make sure?
Spring was a scorcher in the Mediterranean. A heat wave in April saw temperatures up to 20 degrees Celsius higher than usual in Algeria, Morocco, Portugal, and Spain. And now Greece is hitting temperatures as high as 46 degrees Celsius. Scientists used to hesitate to blame a particular piece of weather on climate change. These days, they're more confident. World Weather Attribution, a network of climate modelers, reckons that the heat wave was made around 100 times more likely by the greenhouse gases that are piling up in the atmosphere. In a paper published on May the 26th in NPJ Climate and Atmospheric Science by the Hadley Centre, a branch of the British Met Office, they look at what might be in store for the Mediterranean and the Middle East in the future, even hotter world. They were particularly interested in how often the region can expect to see days in which the mercury rises above 50 degrees Celsius. Scientists at the Hadley Centre used data from a dozen sites around the region, from Turkey and Spain to Egypt and Qatar. They first simulated a pre-industrial world in which humans had not yet begun to significantly alter the atmosphere. They found that 50 degrees Celsius days were virtually impossible under those conditions. Only in Saudi Arabia and on the coast of Tunisia could they happen, and even then, only once a century or so. The team then rerun their models using a standard middle-of-the-road scenario for future emissions. It assumes countries will make some effort to curb climate change, but few truly radical adjustments. In that world, the level of carbon dioxide in the air levels, off at around 600 parts per million by 2100, up from around 420 ppm today. They found the likelihood that at least one day each year will exceed 50 degrees Celsius increased rapidly by the middle of the century for all but the coolest Mediterranean locations such as Spain. By 2100, such days will become once-in-a-decade events across the Mediterranean and the Middle East. Spikes above 45 degrees Celsius are likely every year. That means more droughts and fires. 2022 was the second worst European wildfire season on record, and most were in the Mediterranean. Extreme heat melts roads, buckles railways, and makes outdoor work dangerous. Heat waves already cause 8% of all weather-related deaths. Very high temperatures and humidity can even prevent people shedding heat through sweating, which can eventually kill them. Countries in the Mediterranean and the Middle East are used to the heat, but the future will be very different from the past if wildfires persist. The problem of global warming is closely related to forest fires. Every year in Greece, hundreds of hectares of land turn into ashes. This year, the country has experienced almost 600 wildfires in 10 days, and the summer is not over yet. The National Observatory of Athens thus coordinated a new pan-European network called European Network on Extreme Fire Behavioral that studies and forecasts extreme forest fires, also known as NERO, which was recently selected to be financed by the intergovernmental organization COST, that is the European Cooperation in Science and Technology, for the next 4 years up to 2027. The coordination and supervision of the NERO action is undertaken by Dr. Thodoris Yanaros, mandated researcher of the Center for Environmental Research and Sustainable Development and member of the meteor unit specializing in the field of pyrometeorology. Mr. Yanaros, good morning and welcome to our program.
Good morning and thank you very much for the invitation.
Could you please start by telling us what is the NERO network and how does it work?
The NERO network is what we call a cost action. It's a research project that does not directly finance research and development, but instead it finances networking activities with the purpose to bring together researchers from different disciplines and different levels of expertise across Europe in order together tackle a critical research question.
Are these professionals who are either the firefighters or the people involved in the civil protection?
In some cases, yes, it is not obligatory, but this is actually the novelty of our pan-European network because we have already around one quarter of our participants to be from the professional sector. We talk about practitioners, either they are employed in civil protection agencies or fire services across Europe. And this is because we want to bring together researchers and the practitioners to connect researchers and practitioners in order to co-advance knowledge and develop better predictive services and tools for extreme wildfires.
What do these professionals and practitioners tell you about the wildfires? Especially the last few years, we've seen so many wildfires and burning so much land.
Exactly. One thing is that there is the scientific community concludes that the more frequent occurrence of extreme wildfires denotes the dawn of a new era where we will be getting more and more extreme wildfires. On the other hand, practitioners, what they tell us is that they have to cope with wildfires that are almost impossible to be controlled and contained. And this is because of the occurrence of extreme fire behavior that can develop unexpectedly and also endanger those operating in the field, either on the ground or through the air.
Mm-hmm. Once a wildfire breaks out and expands, experts say that it's like chasing an air mattress. How true is that?
Every fire, how it will spread and how it will behave depends actually on the interplay between three factors. And these three factors include the weather, topography and fuels. So you have the interplay between these factors that often will lead to the occurrence of extreme fire behavior. And this is when we end up chasing the fire. Currently, because the interactions between these three factors, weather, topography and fuels, are practically unlimited, we have limited knowledge on what are these conditions that could lead to the occurrence of extreme fire behavior. There are some things that we know, like that these interactions are non-linear and that on certain occasions we have certain thresholds, processes that lead to overcoming certain thresholds that then lead to the occurrence of extreme fire behavior. But this is why we get this new action, this new cost action NERO, to unravel all these interactions between fuels, topography and weather and gain a better understanding of what are the conditions that promote extreme fire behavior.
Going back to 2007 till today, how many of these wildfires we had, because we've had many and every year we have even more, are due to arson or due to other reasons?
Unfortunately, we do not have such detailed information in Europe, at least in Greece, where I currently work. There is no detailed information on the causes of fire ignitions. However, it is common knowledge that the vast majority of fire ignitions, at least in the Mediterranean and in Greece, are due to arsons, either by negligence or by intention. And also, we will have to include in this category of arsons the failures that often happen in power distribution networks. Yet, we do not have exact and quantitative data to talk about.
Will the NERO network try to beat that?
I suppose yes, because one of the goals of the neural network is to collect and integrate all the kinds of data that are related to wildfires across Europe. And having the knowledge of the cause of fire ignitions would be extremely helpful, because it will help us to increase awareness of the public, and in order not to get such many ignitions, at least due to negligence.
You say you talk to those who are experts and firefighters, and obviously these guys, they're experienced, they've treated wildfires before, and they've investigated those wildfires that happened in the past. What do they tell you?
What they tell us is that when we talk about extreme wildfires, we talk about wildfires that are almost impossible to contain and maintain. And this is because extreme fire behavior may occur unexpectedly, may occur under conditions that we currently do not fully understand. And as you understand, this is a very dangerous situation for those operating in the field. So obviously they are requiring a lot of support. And this is where science comes in, to provide better predictive services and tools to support safer and more effective fire suppression strategies.
Can you foresee where a fire will expand?
Yes, yes. As I told you earlier, every fire, the way it will spread and the behavior depends upon the interplay of three factors, weather, topography and fuels. And we can currently analyze conditions in the field, take fire weather data, data about the topography and the fuels that are burning, and use this data to do what is called fire analysis. In addition, we also have coupled fire atmosphere models that are models that couple a typical meteorological model with a fire spread model. And these models are able to provide the forecasts of how a fire will spread and behave up to the next 24 or more hours.
So to visualize that better, you have like a map where you see the moment that a fire breaks out, you can actually locate where the fire is? Or do you also foresee that in that particular area, there is a big chance that a fire might break out?
Yeah, talking about the chance of a fire breaking out, we can only talk about what we call fire danger. And fire danger is actually depends on fire weather conditions that can be predicted, so we can have a clear view of which areas within a geographic region are most vulnerable for a wildfire to occur. Of course, for a wildfire to ignite, you need someone to provide the spark, and this is on most occasions, as we told earlier, man-made causes. But if you have a fire ignited, then if we talk about fire analysis, what we have to do is to get all the data we can have for the region where the fire is spreading. And this data includes the vegetation that is burning, information about the fuels, information about the topography, a topographic map, and of course information about the current fire weather conditions and how these conditions are expected to evolve based on the meteorological forecast. If we analyze these conditions, we can predict more or less successfully the movement of the fire fronts and identify the regions where we can more effectively and more safely tackle and attempt to contain the fire.
We've seen flames and roads starting in the middle of the night, and we saw a fire in Kifisia at 7:30 in the morning. How normal is that?
This is not normal, especially considering what we have been used to experiencing in the past, but there is also an explanation for this. This is because as a result of the climate change, our nights are becoming warmer and drier. And contrary to the past, where temperature would typically drop and humidity increase during the nighttime hours, we now see temperatures remaining high and humidity remaining low. And this narrows the nighttime time window that is typically used by firefighting agencies to more effectively contain and control the fire. You see, if you have hot and dry weather conditions during the night, the fire can still burn intensively with high intensity, and this can make it difficult for the crews to control it.
Even in places where we've seen no fire whatsoever, I mean, this particular spot, there was no blaze whatsoever. Is it even possible in places where we haven't seen any blazes whatsoever in the middle of the night and suddenly, you know, we see a spark and a fire has been ignited? Is that normal? Can this actually happen without human intervention?
No. You can't have self-ignition. You can't have self-ignition. You need a spark, and this spark is actually provided either by a human hand, negligence or intention, or a power distribution network, or the only other case that can ignite a fire is a lightning. That are the only causes. We cannot talk about the self-ignition of vegetation.
Mm-hmm. We've seen almost 600 fires in the last 10 days. Did you expect so many fires in such little time?
Honestly, not. And I am disappointed to seeing these numbers of fire ignitions, because when we talk about fire ignitions, we talk about people that ignite fires. That is what we have to communicate. For a fire to ignite, we need this spark, and this spark, we talk about it earlier, how it is provided. What is surprising, but also we have been expecting that, is the intensity and extent of these fires. And this is because of the fire weather conditions that are prevailing in our region and are connected to the effects of climate change.
So what are the challenges of the NARO network?
The main challenge, I would say, is to bring really close and together practitioners and researchers to work together and co-develop new knowledge and co-develop new predictive tools and services. NARO does not want to follow the traditional approach followed in research projects where you have a researcher developing a tool or a service and then providing it to the practitioner as who acts as an end user. We want practitioners to work with us because we have a lot to learn from them, and they have also a lot to learn from us. So we need to co-develop knowledge and break all these silos that exist across Europe that currently keeps our communities apart.
Mm-hmm. Once a fire starts, provided there is a strong wind as well, but at what stage can a fire be averted, and at what stage there's nothing that can be done about it?
When you have an extreme wildfire, a wildfire that presents extreme fire behavior, we need to understand that these wildfires cannot currently be contained by any firefighting crew across the world. Extreme wildfires are actually like monsters that will consume all the vegetation that is available and will eventually stop when you don't have any other vegetation left, or when, or only when fire weather conditions will allow them to stop. For example, when the weather becomes less hot and more humid and with lower intensity winds.
With zero wind in Evia back then, there was no chance that this fire could be averted.
Yeah, no chance. As long as it got to the condition it got, there was no chance of stopping this fire. And this is because in the Evia Island, as well as in the Attica and the Peloponnese wildfires that we got back in 2021, these were pyroconvective wildfires. And by pyroconvective wildfires, we mean fires that couple with the atmosphere and begin generating their own weather. And they create these impressive fire clouds, which are called pyroclouds. We even had above the city of Athens the formation of a pyrocumulonimbus, which is similar to a thunderstorm cloud, but this cloud was generated by the fire itself. And such wildfires as the 2021 in Greece are possible to change, to create their own weather in a very effective way, since they burn very intensively under very hot and dry conditions. And it is because of the low wind speed intensities that they were able to do so.
And there's no technology that can actually stop them right now?
There's kind of no technology that can actually stop or effectively suppress them, but there is knowledge that we can use in order to be better prepared for the occurrence of such wildfires, be better aware of the conditions that could turn a typical fire into a pyroconvective one. And this is the knowledge we will also try to produce within the NARO network, to provide some tools and guidances that could be used by practitioners to identify those situations where you may have a fire developing into pyroconvective one, and hence avoid handicap with a pyroconvective fire and trying to contain a monster.
You basically telling me that in the case of Evia now with roads, once a fire creates its own climate and its own weather conditions, no humans can do anything about it.
We cannot do anything about it, meaning that we cannot directly attack the fire. This is where we need the fire analysis. We need to analyze the situation, see if the fire is paraconvective or wind-driven, and then identify time windows in the day and the night, and also geographic regions where we can be prepared to defend and try then to contain the fire. Because, you see, attacking the fire directly, attacking the paraconvective fire directly, has no meaning. We need another strategy, a strategy that analyzes all the factors that determine the extreme wildfire, and then developing a strategy on a map to identify where we can try to stop the fire.
Can you explain us a little bit further of that strategy?
The strategy means that you will have to analyze all the conditions that influence how the fire spreads and behaves. And these factors are, again, weather, fuels, and topography. So for a particular region, we know the fuels that are burning. We also know the topography. We can have a topographic map, and then you can have information about fire weather. What is the current fire weather, and what the fire weather in the next 6, 12, or 24 hours will be like. So if you have this information and analyze it, you can predict, at least to some extent, how the fire will spread. And this will give you the opportunity to identify potential regions like an agricultural field or a region where you will have less vegetation and you expect the fire to decelerate. So you can identify these regions and then move your firefighting crews to these regions and try to stop the fire from spreading further.
But might take a longer time, actually. When you predict, how long does this take to arrive to the assumption that the fire will reach that particular region and then it will more likely be tangible there than that you can actually manage the fire in that particular spot and then just bring the fire crew there?
Yeah, I wouldn't say that it will take a lot of time. I mean, even if we use a numerical model, I could tell you that such models can provide a six-hour forecast of how the fire will spread in about 30 minutes. And also a fire analysis would be more or less accomplished in the same time. And I think that this approach is much better than running behind the fire and trying to attack and stop a fire at a region where it is not possible to be stopped.
Did this happen in Evia too?
Yeah. The Evia fire was a mega fire, showed extreme fire behavior. We have been witnessing the formation of pyroconvective clouds each and every day, and all these pyroconvective clouds were generating their own weather. The fire was generating its own weather. The fire fronts were very extended, and the fire was burning intensively, so it was pretty hard to be stopped.
So it was best to leave it as it was, just to burn whatever it was going to burn and stop by itself?
No. That's not what I'm saying. It's no better to leave a fire just burn, unless it's a surface low-intensity fire that may be ecologically beneficial. But in the case of extreme wildfires, I'm not telling that it's best to let them burn. What I'm saying, and what NIRO will try to do, is to establish procedures that are based on science and that can help those building the strategy in the field to better and more effectively battle the blazes. And this includes what we have been talking about, fire analysis. You need to take into account all the factors that determine fire spread and behavior. Be aware that you cannot always attack the fire, and be able to define a strategy that will give you the best chances of stopping the fire from spreading further.
So if and when NIRO starts to operate, when does it start to operate, by the way?
It will begin in October 2023, and it is a four-year cost action, which means that we will go up to October 2027.
Mm-hmm. So if and when NIRO starts to operate, are you hopeful that we will not see wildfires as mega as we've seen in Evia in the future, or at least we'll have the means to avert them?
I would like to be optimistic and say that our goal is by the end of NIRO to have better tools available, to have a much closer collaboration between practitioners in the scientific community at the European level, because it is a good thing to share manpower and aerial firefighting means, like we currently do in the framework of the Union Civil Protection Mechanism. However, we need to invest much more in the exchange of knowledge and expertise, And this is also important for the northern countries as well, because as a result of the climate change, all these fires, the occurrence of fire, also moves to northern latitudes. So countries that traditionally had no problems with wildfires, like, for example, Germany, Scandinavia, the United Kingdom, are now getting more often fire events that are of considerable intensity. So I would say that by 2027, I would like to see NERO ending up with a close collaboration, close bonds between researchers and the practitioners, and new knowledge, new information about what we can do to be better prepared for extreme wildfires.
Mm-hmm. How many countries actually participate right now in the NERO action?
We currently have 70 European countries participating. However, the network is open. This is how Coast Actions work. It is open to any European country that would like to participate. And I would say that it's our goal to have as many countries as possible. And we also have collaboration within the NERO network with the US and Canada.
If fire breaks out in Greece, for example, will these countries help, come to help us?
Yeah, that is one ambitious goal of NERO as well. I mean, I would say that, after 2 years of NERO, I would like to see that kind of collaboration. I mean, if we have a wildfire in Greece, I would like to see NERO having something like a task force that would be devoted to do all this job of fire analysis and maybe provide some information of how it would be best to battle this wildfire.
Mr. Yannaros, thank you very much for joining us and have a very
You're
nice
welcome.
Day. And that was Dr. Thodoris Yannaros, researcher of the Center for Environmental Research and Sustainable Development and member of the Meteo Unit specializing in the field of pyrometeorology.
I saw on the news today 100 homes were washed away. Stormy waters pouring from the skies. Met the seas as they began to rise. Elsewhere of water, there's no drop. This man's crop was lost due to the change of climate. A forest going up in fire, ice cuts melting, seas going high. Well, you wanna know how can this be? Will we too be touched by tragedy? Folks cooked their food on wood and kept warm as best they could. And then some wonderful black rocks, cold coal, warmed their homes and made their railroads roll. And when oil came gushing, that we could go far in our car without thinking about the change. Oil and coal and natural gas were created eons past. Carbon luck within them will go free when we burn them for electricity. A carbon joins with air to make up something new. CO2, too much of it will change.
Much of Europe remains haunted by the 2003 heatwave that killed more than 70,000 people. The good news is that natural disasters like heatwaves are becoming less deadly around the world. Better forecasting and more tools to cope with heatwaves saved lives in Europe. But with disrupted travel, increasing hospital visits and lost productivity, heat is still extracting a growing social and economic toll. However, scientists are still trying to figure out how the current European heatwave fits into previous forecasts and whether it's more extreme than predicted. Climate models do show that Europe is capable of reaching triple-digit temperatures in the current era, but researchers are calculating how much more likely they've become. The current heat wave isn't over yet, and it will take some time to compare climate predictions to the actual results. Researchers are also investigating exactly how much human-caused climate change made it worse. And climate change is expected to nudge future thermometers even higher, as hot as it's already been. This might sadly likely be still one of the coolest summers we're going to experience for the rest of our lives. I'm Katerina Badzaki. Join us next week to indulge our curiosity in another of our infinitely curious programs of Earth and the Voice of Greece. Meanwhile, try to stay cool wherever you are and protect the green spaces around you in whatever way you can. It is the sole oxygen we have to maintain our health, balance, and beauty around us.
Shaking of its leafy head has killed.